Welcome to Sentence to Paragraph, a podcast on the space between wordcraft and the writer's life. My name is Darilyn Evans, and I'm joined today with a special guest co-host, Leah Velez. Leah writes speculative fiction and works with us here at Wordcrafters. Welcome, Leah.
Hello.
So fun to have you here. So today, this is our first live and in-person podcast. We're recording at Wordcrafters Workshop, and we have an amazing special guest author joining us. Leah, do you want to go ahead and introduce our guest?
Sure. Today, we're talking with Karen Thompson Walker, who just released The Dreamers, which everybody should go read. It's amazing. She's the author of the New York Times best-selling novel, The Age of Miracles, which has been translated into 27 languages and named one of the best books of the year by People, the Oprah Magazine, and Financial Times, among others. And I hear it's about to be made into a television series with AMC, produced by 21 Labs, who are the same producers of Stranger Things. Super exciting. Beyond these amazing credentials and the magical world she crafts as a writer, I've been honored the opportunity to experience the worlds Karen builds with her teacher hat on. She's an endlessly patient and incredibly astute reader who's always searching for the way to help any story to its best self, something most of us who teach writing try to do with varying levels of success. But the questions she asks have sent me into revision mode, just completely inspired. She never tells you what to do. She digs into your subconscious self with the questions she asks, and your answers come from within, all while being so kind, so she tricks you into thinking these ideas were in you the entire time, which I guess they were, but she's a legend. I digress. Let me get back to the bio. Karen Thompson Walker was born and raised in San Diego and is a graduate of UCLA and the Columbia MFA program. She lives with her husband, the novelist Casey Walker, and their two daughters in Portland. She's an assistant professor of creative writing at the University of Oregon here in Eugene. And I just said Oregon like a Chicagoan. I am very sorry. Karen Thompson Walker, welcome to Sentence to Paragraph.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad to be here. And thank you so much for that nice introduction.
We are thrilled to have you here with us. I'm still recovering from reading The Dreamers up until like 4 a.m. on Tuesday night. It's so wonderful because it just sucks you in, and there is such an urgency to the narrative. And I want you to talk about this. How did you come up with The Dreamers, and what made you want to write this book?
Thank you. Thanks for that. I've always been interested in disaster stories in general. I mean, my first book had to do with a disaster, but maybe contagion stories in particular. One of my favorite books is Blindness by Jose Saramago. And that was just a really influential book for all of my work, just the way that he takes that story is about, an epidemic of a mysterious blindness that spreads through a city. And so that sort of has always been with me. And I always thought, like, maybe someday I'll try to write a contagion story of my own. And I think I realized a thing that's interesting about contagion stories is how a contagion generates a certain amount of sort of narrative momentum, because you're wondering who's going to get it next. But there's also something so human about it, the way that the person who lives alone in the woods in the middle of nowhere is never going to catch the thing that's spreading through humanity. So there's something inherently sort of reflective of human connections in a contagion story. So that chance to sort of see how a sickness spreads from, close family members, but then also the stranger that, someone that you buy something from at the store. And so having the opportunity to kind of map those things at the same time as telling a hopefully those kind of important human relationships at the same time as telling a hopefully page turning story felt exciting. And I started writing it not actually knowing what I knew it would be a strange, rapidly spreading sickness, but I actually didn't know wasn't sure what the symptom should be. And so I wrote just a few pages of this idea of what if a sickness started to spread in a tight dorm floor college environment, which is where The Dreamers is set or where it begins. But I just got a few pages in and wasn't really sure where I was going. Until, and this is the part that I always say I'm tempted to cut out of my talk about this book, I got the idea for it to be a contagious sleeping sickness from a dream. And that I think about taking out because it sounds sort of cheesy. But I really did have this one of those, this type of dream where I was like sort of on the verge of waking up. I started to dream that I couldn't wake up. Like, you know, that I was sort of trapped in sleep. And soon after I did wake up, I thought, now that is what that's what the symptom of this strange sickness should be. A kind of sleep that locks people in.
Wow.
Well, at the very end of the book, there's the moment with the character who do get stuck in that, and I feel like that was like the most terrifying part of the book, and where I was really riveted was that idea of being paralyzed, because we've been watching it from the outside for the whole time,
right.
And then all of a sudden you're in there, and it brings up the tension a lot. It's interesting to hear you say that it came from that.
Yes, yeah. Oh, good. I'm glad that worked. Yeah, I mean, different characters, you know, you sort of see it in different ways, but it was exciting to after a long time of wondering what these many sleepers in town, what's going on in their brains, to then try to occupy one of them.
That was brilliant.
All right. Well, before we get too far, I would love to hear you read a little bit from your book. Do you have an excerpt for us today?
Yes, I would love to. I'll just read the opening.
And then all of you will have to race out right now and go buy it.
Did you say five minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. It might be a little shorter, but okay. This is the beginning, like I said. One. At first, they blame the air. It's an old idea, a poison in the ether, a danger carried in by the wind. A strange haze is seen drifting through town on that first night, the night the trouble begins. It arrives like weather, or like smoke, some say later, but no one can locate any fire. Some blame the drought, which has been bleeding away the lake for years and browning the air with dust. Whatever this is, it comes over them quietly. A sudden drowsiness, a closing of the eyes. Most of the victims are found in their beds. But there are some who will tell you that this sickness is not entirely new, that its cousins have sometimes visited ours. In certain letters from earlier centuries, you may find the occasional reference, decades apart, to a strange kind of slumber, a mysterious, persistent sleep. In 1935, two children went to bed in a dust bowl cabin and did not wake for 9 days. Some similar contagion once crept through a Mexican village, El Niente they called it, the nothing. And 3,000 years before that, a Greek poet described a string of strange deaths in a village near the sea. They died, he wrote, as if overcome by sleep, or, according to a second translation, as if drowned in a dream. This time it starts at the college. It starts with a girl leaving a party. She feels sick, she tells her friends, like a fever, she says, like the flu, and tired, too, as tired as she has ever felt in her life. The girl's roommate, May, will later recall waking to the sound of the key turning in the lock. May will remember the squeak of the springs in the dark as her roommate, her name is Kara, climbs into the bunk above hers. She seems drunk, this girl, the way she moves so slowly from door to bed, but the room is dim, and, as usual, they do not speak. In the morning, May sees that Kara has slept in her clothes. The narrow black heels of her boots are sticking out beneath the blankets of the upper bunk, but May has seen her do this once before. She is careful not to wake her as she dresses. She is quiet with her keys and with the door. May leaves only the lightest possible impression in this space. The comfort of not being seen. This is California, Santa Laura, 6 weeks into May's freshman year. Stop there.
Oh, so good.
Thank you.
I want to dive right back in. So I get, okay, so I already said for me, what sucks me in is that urgency, that voice and tone, and hearing you read it is just so amazing. But as we're reading through the book, we have all of these different point of view characters who we're dipping in and out of, and yet, and which often in a book can make it kind of feel either disjointed or slow it down. But it just moves right along. And I wonder how, well, and also I just felt like the immensity of their lives in this moment. Could you talk about how you approach the craft of these? You know, you have these very distinct voices from one another in thought and action, and yet it's a very cohesive narrative voice. So I'll just let you start there.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a big sort of challenge of this book was figuring out how it was going to work. And I knew kind of early on that I wanted a sort of a large cast of characters to take advantage of what I was saying before, that how a sickness travels from one person to the next. And so I kind of wanted to have that feeling in the narrative voice that we're kind of moving from one character to the next. And so I was excited about that possibility, but it was a little hard to figure out who the characters would be. And also, I think figuring out the voice was a big part of it, sort of what could this voice do. And in the end, I went with a pretty elastic type of voice, so that at times it's maybe truly omniscient, but then it can kind of zoom in whenever I want it to into people's heads. And I guess, yeah, I mean, figuring out who they were was a big part of the challenge. There was at least one character that I sort of tested out, and I just couldn't really figure out who he was or what I was going to do with him, and eventually just cut that character out. Mm-hmm. So there's a bit of trial and error. And it was different than my first book, because my first book I started with a different level of familiarity. Even though my first book has a totally fantastical premise and all the events are made up, there still is this feeling of like a California childhood that's a lot like what my childhood was like. And whereas in The Dreamers, I was making people up, inventing people to a different degree, that was kind of felt like a new thing for me that I had to, yeah, kind of find my way through. I don't know if that exactly answers your question, but
how long did it take you to go through the process of that and writing the book and finding the different voices? And how do you do that? Do you you kind of mentioned you wrote scenes, or you wrote into some folks? What's the process?
I mean, I usually start with a premise or a situation. Like, that's the first kernel for me. But then I can't really start writing pages until I have at least one character, because otherwise, I need to kind of have a human being going through the situation. So I guess May came to me very early. She's mentioned here, this young, and she's at the beginning of the book, this college freshman, who's sort of a kind of observer, shy observer type. So that was that. I knew that she would be part of it early on, and then the other characters came to me, I guess, gradually over maybe a year or two. And then I actually added one character after I had finished an entire draft, and I thought I was close to done, but my editor suggested adding one more character. So one of the characters I added actually very late.
Oh wow!
Yeah, which was
what is that like to weave someone new in?
I mean, it was the kind of suggestion. I have a really great, really thorough editor, Kate Medina, and the first time I heard it, I was like, what? How could I've spent 4 years writing this book with these characters. Like, how could I can't imagine a new character. But she had a kind of specific idea that she had a kind of felt that there was a need for someone who comes in from the outside to try to figure out what's going on, that sort of feeling, to offer like just another perspective. And it was the kind of thing, I heard it that day, and then like by the next day I was like, well, maybe I could think of someone. And then by the third day I was like, okay, I got it. And it's not that I had it all figured out, but I feel like that's because she was right that it needed that, so that then I hadn't seen that there was like a kind of a hole. And within a few days it felt like, how could I have not seen the hole? So the character that I added late was, I mean, she's maybe one of the more minor characters, but still important. She's a psychiatrist who comes in, and is trying to figure out what's going on. And she comes in from the outside. So that was the character that I added kind of late.
Did you have a follow-up question to that?
I guess in terms of like the world-building elements, I've taken a seminar in speculative fiction with you, and I know a lot of what you talked about was rule building and setting it up in a way where people coming in from expecting real situations will buy in. Mm-hmm. And I guess like having that outside voice, does that have something to do with that legitimization of the
interesting. Of the world? That's a good question. You know, I feel like this book, I tried, like, the sleeping sickness is invented for sure, but then I wanted that to be like, I thought of it as that's my big leap, taking this sleeping sickness, but then there's a sort of secondary leap of the strangeness of the dreams, which I hope is related to the first leap, but I do think a lot about that, like trying to make it feel during the time that you're reading, like that it's convincing and follows logic. And so, yeah, maybe I don't know if I exactly thought of it in that way, but I think it's true that having the psychiatrist come in and hearing a little bit of that from her perspective, I think it does. It was also a way of bringing the subject of dreams in earlier on in my original draft. They really came in very late, and so that was related to that too. Like she was able to sort of raise the possibility of what's going on in their brains in a new way. So.
Can you talk more about the logical progression of, like, building those rules and how that worked, like, in your drafting process and how you kind of, like, how hard it is to stick to the rules once you've created them and how do you determine, like, what goes in and what doesn't?
Yeah, let's see. I guess, I mean, I would say, so I'm a fan of the one big leap, where you announce something at the very beginning of a book or a story, and then that's the thing that's weird or different about if you're going to write a fantastical story, rather than a completely different world where there's a million things that are different. Not that that can't work too, but just as a writer, I sort of like that one big leap. And then from then on, I just try to apply my own sense of logic and reality for how it would unfold. And that comes a lot from Blind. The first time I started thinking about that was how well Jose Saramago does that in Blindness. And he has this idea, I think he calls it he writes about the possibility of the impossible. So it's like he might choose a crazy premise right at the beginning, but from then on it's very logical. So in the case of the dreamers, I did a lot of research about, even though I invented this sickness, and there's a sort of certain things about it that are maybe kind of are kind of extraordinary. I still did a bunch of research about how, you know, known contagious diseases really do spread, like what rate different ones spread at and what would happen or what has happened when a new sickness breaks out. And I mean, in terms of like what the government does, even though it doesn't go into a ton, the book is not a lot about those things. I still wanted there to feel like it wanted to be convincing as you're reading it.
How does the research process work for you on that? Like the different viruses, the response, how do you weave in those facts?
Yeah, I did a fair amount of research at the beginning, but I guess my main way of researching is to answer questions as I have them. So I came up with the idea of this strange sickness spreading quickly through a college town, and then I could sometimes hit little walls where I'm like, well, like, how would the college respond, or how fast would it be spreading among these students, and by what means? So I start to think, like, oh, I need to maybe not stop writing, but kind of pause and read more about contagious diseases. Or when I started to get the idea of something is going on what's going on in their brains and what kind of dreams they might be having, then I started to feel like, well, I don't really know enough about the history of dreams or about what, to whatever degree there is a science of what's going on in the dreaming brain. I didn't know enough about that to fully, like, take full advantage of what, you know, and start writing about those parts. So then I would, you know, I read a bunch of books about sleep science and dreaming. And so, I don't know, I just, you know, if I notice an interesting detail, I'll flag it, but often I'm looking for the answer to something as I'm researching, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so you have all of these tiny details within the book that, where you have the water that leaks or the dogs that appear and then show up later, people that don't get named in one section, and then we recognize them by small physical traits later and notice them. And so they're kind of woven through the novel. And I was just wondering, like, in the creation of the world as you're drafting, how do you go about layering these kinds of things, and how do you keep up with all the threads? And was this something that you had in mind from the very beginning, or did it kind of just happen organically?
I mean, I'm always figuring things out along the way. I guess I was, once I decided to have this, have a lot of going, a large cast of characters and going into a lot of different heads, I wanted there to still be a feeling of like a cohesive and forward moving reading experience. So some of those were like solutions to those things, because I feel like in general, a kind of classic way for a novel to work would be something that happens early on then causes a consequence later, you know, I mean, maybe more than one thing, but just that there's like a sense of building consequence in a logical way. So I tried to make those things like, and that's simpler if it's just one person's story. Like, they made a choice here, and then the consequence, it happens 2 weeks later, and it's X, Y, Z. So I tried to see if I could find opportunities for that, like, to braid through, like, have things that braid through. So, like, someone who shows up in one section, there might be some consequence or some later role in a later section. And that, I looked for opportunities for that, and it was all so that hopefully there would be, yeah, like, a cohesive, forward-moving reading experience.
Do you use, like... I'm a spreadsheet person. Do you use do you flag them in certain ways, or like in the writing process, like how do you keep track of it all? Because a novel is such a huge beast of a thing.
Yeah, I keep a lot of notes. Okay. I don't do anything quite so organized as a spreadsheet, yeah. Even though it seems like a great idea.
I think it's not. It's a huge rabbit hole. It's terrible.
I think the thing that my main organizational tool is that I write in chronological order. So that there's like a certain, there's just a certain organization to that, because I come to chapter 5 and it's like, well, what happened in chapters 1 through 4? Like, but, and if I need something, if I'm like, oh, let's say I want a character to show, like a secondary character to show up in a scene or to come to the house, then I think like, well, are there any that have already appeared that I could reuse that might give it a kind of tighter braid of the narrative? So I think writing in order helps a lot. So, or like, yeah, like those details, like just using details that I might have, looking back for what I've already written, using those things as opportunities for later. But not everyone needs to write in chronological order, but that's just my one. I feel like that has been really useful to me.
How much do you know ahead of time? There's lots of discussion of plotters versus pantsers in writing. How much do you know ahead of time where you're writing towards, or what, you know, do you spend a little time plotting out? So as you're writing in chronological order, you know where you're headed, or do you just have a general sense or some larger arcs, or is it pure discovery from chapter 1 into chapter 2, etc.?
I definitely don't like to know. I don't lay it all out. I don't have it all outlined and figured out, but I like to have the feeling of possibility. I think that comes from maybe like the kind of writing that I have done so far have these big premises. So once I start writing a book where there's a contagious sleeping sickness spreading through a college town, you know, certain arcs appear in the reader's mind too, right. Just in anyone's mind. Like, what among the things that could happen, what is going to happen? So I like the feeling. I like to know that there's like a variety of possibilities, and then I just am sort of mulling as I'm writing forward. I'm mulling sort of which ones I'm going to sort of take advantage of, and which doors I'm going to go through, and which ones I'm going to end up closing. So yeah, and I sometimes have a sort of sense of what note I want to end on, so that I have, but other than that, I don't necessarily have it all figured out. And actually, I didn't realize I was writing, I was pretty far in when I decided to make, like, I was really interested in sleep and this contagions of sleep and like being unconscious, but I was pretty far in before I decided to make dreaming a big part of this book. So that it, even though it hopefully logically come, you know, if you're writing about sleep, yeah. Dreams are part of sleep, like there's, it's not a far leap, but I it took me, like, I was probably, I don't know, 50 or 100 pages in before I decided to really make that be a big part of the sickness. And then I went back some and like sort of seeded more dream references, but anyway, so I'm always discovering things as I go too, and I think I like that. Like, when I hear about people who have like a 40-page outline for their 300-page book, like that would not be appealing to me, because the fun of, like, every day when I'm sitting down, I like to have a feeling of possibility, and like I'm not quite sure exactly how something's gonna go.
Mm-hmm. How do you keep that on track? And I'm also a pantser more than a plotter, or using structure. Like, do you have kind of an overall structure sense that, or maybe just an inherent one, but just so that you know what's happening, you know, like, of the 4 million things that could possibly happen each day, this keeps you on track to not go down too many rabbit holes? Or is it okay to go down rabbit, like, how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, first, I just want to say I feel like every writer has to just figure out their own way. Right. So that's just the truth of it. But for me, that might get back to the, I like to have a premise. I like to have a big premise. Mm-hmm. And so that acts in some ways as a control. Like, you know, I'm writing a book about a contagious sleeping sickness, so I like how it that allowed me to, like, there is a lot of room still. Like, I could tell people's backstories and, you know, what their family lives are like and stuff, but this is a book about the contagious sleeping sickness in the college town. So if I was just writing, like sometimes people begin with character, a lot of writers begin with character, and I feel like great books are produced that way, but that's not a way that I have figured out how to write a book yet, because I'd be like, well, what's the structure, I guess? Like, yeah. So in a way, for
how
me,
do you find that plot?
Yeah, like, is it going to be about their, is it going to be about one day at work, or is it going to be about 40 years of their whole life, or is it going to be about a year in their childhood, or is it going to be like they're on their deathbed? Like, it's hard. I mean, of course you can make those decisions, but I like a story that grows out of the original premise. I mean, as a writer, maybe as a reader too, I think that's satisfying, but it's only one of the things I like to read, whereas it's so far the main thing I like to write, you know?
Okay. So what do you consider your craft? Is it the initial writing phase? Is it the editing phase? Are there particular pieces that as you sit down and craft your story that you're thinking about?
That's an interesting question. I really like editing, and I think I like editing so much that it's actually a primary part of my writing. So the way that I write is I'll, you know, write four sentences, cut one of them, rearrange three of them, add another, then cut the first one, and, you know, cut three more words, and then I'll move on to the next paragraph. So it's like, most of my time is probably the editing, and it's totally wrapped up in the writing process. I mean, I do an edit or more than one of the whole draft or a whole chapter, but a lot of it is like moment by moment editing, and that's, I think I find that to be the most satisfying part. And that's like where I'm spending, like when I go to sit down and write for 2 hours, a lot of it is feels like editing.
How do you keep yourself in that case from getting stuck? Because we know the those writers, maybe I'm looking at myself here, who, like, I can write the first chapter 400 times and never get past it. So how do you, like, do you ever get stuck in that, where it's like, well, I can't go on until it's perfect, but how do you keep the momentum going forward? Because obviously you've done it twice in an amazing way.
Well, that is a big risk to that type of process, though. I don't know if I have a great answer to that. I mean, I think it's slow. I'm a slow writer. I mean, I've spent 4 years, three and a half or four years on my first book, and about five on The Dreamers. So, yeah, it's a slow process. I don't know. Somehow I have gradually moved forward. It's just maybe at a snail's pace. But it is a risk that you can get stuck, it's true. It helps me a lot to have a really polished first chapter, because then that's what I have to sort of stand on and figure out all the rest. So I'm the least likely to allow like a first chapter to feel messy, because then I'd feel lost. I like to have a strong, polished opening, and then if I get a little messy later while I'm figuring things out, that feels more okay to me. But again, that's just like it's my own. I really feel like writers, a fascinating thing about being a writer is that everyone does it in their own way, and that's the only way to do it is your own way. Right. And so a big part of it is figuring out like what works for you. Yeah.
So you think about first pages as being like the foundation of a building?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. Because then if I get later, if I'm like, oh, maybe something is wrong with this fourth chapter, or something in the middle is not going right, then it's like I like the feeling of like stepping back and knowing like, well, it's not that the whole thing is wrong. It's like there's something wrong here, you know? Whereas if I wrote a whole messy draft, which I know is probably most writers do it that way, there's just such a great risk of then being in the middle of being like, this whole book is wrong, you know? I don't know. I like to feel like a confidence about, even if it's only the first five pages, like just a feeling of it as a polished thing. At least at the start.
Yeah, I like that.
What is your obsession as a writer? I think we've kind of talked about, you know, working on a big premise, but also, you know, being a speculative writer. So what do you think your particular obsessions are? Do you have a subject? Do you have themes that run through your stories, or that you kind of obsess about or want to pursue?
Yeah, I mean, I think fear and kind of life or death situations is an obsession of mine, but I think that colors like both of the books I've written and probably the next one I'm gonna write. But I like to kind of use that to shine the feeling of fear or just being at a high stakes moment in life because of an extreme situation. I like to try to use that to shine some kind of light on the meaning and significance of ordinary life. So it's sort of a combination. So it's like I'm writing about these disaster situations, but it's so much also about it's like what's at risk in a disaster situation is the loss of that mundane, ordinary life. And so I guess that's I'd like to write in that space about, you know, yeah, the kind of scary, exciting life or death situation. But also the reason it's meaningful is, yeah, because of the kind of emotional significance of just ordinary human life when there's not something terrible going on.
One of the things I like in particular about The Dreamers is the way that it, a disease like that picks apart what it means to be family and, you know, just even our basic relationships to, you know, you can't, it's, you know, touch and being close to each other and those kinds of things. I think, it, you know, the, how quickly, I guess, humanity or civilization falls apart and just our basic bonds fall apart in that situation. I thought that was really interesting. And it seems like the other book also, it's like it's just what happens when something like that kind of just completely disrupts our basic structures.
Yeah, and like what happens to bonds between people. I'm also interested in the possibility how sometimes bonds can become stronger too. Right. Like some fall apart, they're put under stress, some become stronger or new ones form or surprising ones form. I mean,
Nikki Gonzalez, one of your other students, asked me to ask about, and you mentioned this at the beginning, about the last two books being maybe inspired by dreams that you've had. And she wants to know what you are working on now and if it is dream-inspired.
You know, actually, it's only the second one that's inspired by a dream. Although, I could imagine the first one, The Age of Miracles, is about the sudden slowing of the rotation of the Earth, which, you know, it feels like it could be the type of thing that could be in a dream. But I am, I'm working on another book, not from a dream, but it has to do with, I think it may grow out a little bit of some of the research that I did on The Dreamers, because this one, it has to do with memory and like the weirdness of human psychology related to memory. It's a different situation, but I feel like there's something in common. And it's not a disaster this time. At least that's not the primary story.
All right.
So one of the things our podcast focuses on is it's kind of that journeyman period between, you know, you've kind of done your apprenticeship of writing life, you've put in your 10,000 hours, and now you're out in the world as a working writer, moving towards mastery, emerging from, you know, starting to publish or now on your second book, have a few under your belt, but still kind of early in your career. So I wanted to kind of, because you're a few steps just ahead of a few of us, that what does life look like for you right now? Like, how do you, you know, early in career, things like classes and writing groups and other kinds of support are so important to really learn and master your craft. But once you're out in the world, it kind of feels like you're thrown out into the pool and it's like, okay, sink or swim. How do you maintain that connection to community, and you know, what kind of supports are do you need or have been helpful for you, like classes or writing groups or just a few key readers? Or what does life look like after now that you're out in the world with two really amazing books under your belt?
I mean, I you know, a lot of my closest friends are writers, and so they, I have a kind of informal, I'm not part of a writing group, but it's just like an informal group of people that when I want or need readers, even before I show it to my editor, they're there and really smart readers. And my husband's also a writer, so he's always my first reader. Yeah, I guess I think it's important to maintain like connections with other writers, even if they're not reading, just to be able to talk about what you're thinking about and what, even just like which books you've read lately. You know, I definitely feel like it helps to stay close with other writers. I mean, that's been an important thing. And then I guess the thing that's changed in my life in the last couple of years is starting to teach full-time in a creative writing program. I mean, yeah, undergrad and graduate students. And that has been really, I mean, that's totally different than what my life was like before, but it's been really, I think it's sort of been good for my writing brain too, even though it takes some of my writing time. It's also just having to kind of articulate things that have maybe become intuitive is useful, I think, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's why I feel like teaching is sometimes is, you're trying to articulate something to a student that maybe not everything is intuitive, but certain things have become intuitive for me as I'm writing. And then I'm like, well, why did I make that choice? And it's kind of useful to have to think it through and try to explain it to a student. And hopefully it's useful to them too.
It is.
I promise.
Useful to me.
Yeah. have things like writing routine or writing, I guess even just writing life in general, like, are you a consistent writer? Do you write every day? Those kinds of things. But also thinking about how has that changed, especially in the last couple of years with family and teaching and whatnot, and what tools have you used to help keep you on track, or what maybe rabbit holes have you gone down and found your way back from? Practicing writer.
Yeah. I mean, by nature, I'm a sort of daily writer. Like, it's best for me to write every day or almost every day, and maybe only for an hour or two. Like, that's sort of my natural way. But I have two young children, and now I have this teaching job, so I've had to be a little more flexible in that. But it's still important for me to be writing really frequently, even if it's maybe 3 days a week. Oh, an important thing for me that I figured it out or learned it when I was right out of graduate school, but then it comes back again and again, which is just like, you have to treat your writing in a way like a job, or at least not like a full-time job, because most people don't have like 40 hours a week to devote to it, but just not something that can be skipped, you know? And I think that's how I wrote my first book. I had a full-time job in book publishing when I wrote my first book, and I really treated that the morning like an hour as something that I couldn't skip. And I still did fail to do it every single day, but most it felt like something that I really need to do, as if it was a short job. And then I feel like recently, having young children and a teaching job and just like a sort of limited number of childcare hours, there's again that tendency to be like, well, like, nothing's gonna happen if I don't write on Thursday. Like, if I just skip that day, there's going to be no consequence. Whereas if I didn't prepare for my class, or if I didn't like pick my daughter up from preschool, like, there's going to be immediate consequences. So it's like, I have to imagine, like, I have to use my imagination I have to like remember that it is as like over time, it is as important, you know, that I spend that time, maybe not every day, but on the days that I've set aside, and make sure I'm setting aside time, because otherwise, yeah, it could just not happen.
When you talk about it as a job, do you also think about, like, how do you manage the business part of being Karen Thompson Walker with your writing time, and like treating that as a job as well, and how do you kind of allocate?
Yeah, I don't know that I'm so great at that part, but I mean, that is another but that's a good, well, I don't know, the pressure on my time, you know, in terms of like I was lucky to get to do a couple book festivals, and those are good problems to have, but it then intrude further into writing time. And I don't know if I have a great answer. I mean, I think right now I'm thinking it takes me a couple years to write a book, so my life is not always so busy with those things, and when it is, that I try to just feel like kind of glad and lucky. And then in terms of like, I really am not so great and feel kind of conflicted about the like promotional parts or marketing parts being an author. And I wish that wasn't part of it. So I don't have any great tips on that part.
But like even just like querying or like sending things out to publications, yeah, and things like that. Do you have any tips for people maybe looking to send their stuff out on like how to think of yourself as like a job or I don't know if I'm phrasing this correctly, but like as a professional, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it can be good to kind of, I mean, it's a delicate combination, because the most important thing is to get your writing to the place it needs to be. Like, that is step one, even if you are thinking, even on the business side, it's like, first, the writing has to be ready, so it makes sense to spend a lot of time on that part of it. But I don't know, I think there can be something useful about just sort of like owning your identity as a writer, maybe, which can be hard, especially before you publish a book.
To like take yourself seriously.
Yes,
to...
right. In a way, setting aside the time to write is also part of that.
Yeah.
Like, to think of it as like not just a hobby, to take it seriously and give yourself the time to write. And then at the right point to also like invest time in other ways, like figuring out, you know, what the right journals are for you or who the right agents are. And then it's nice later on when you have an agent and a publisher, you can spend a little less time doing that stuff, maybe.
There's hope. Okay.
You had a really amazing and successful book right out of the gate with your debut novel. What surprises or really interesting, unexpected things happened between the first book and the second book coming out?
Oh, you mean
And not necessarily like, oh, the success or the business part of it, but just like, oh, what, you know, was there any aspect of that that was interesting or weird?
I mean, the first time I just had so little sense of what to expect in a way, including even though I worked in book publishing, a thing I had spent almost so little time thinking about is foreign, like, translation, which is, you know, a lucky thing, like, not lots of books published in English don't get translated, so that it was lucky that, my book, I mean, both books have been translated, but that was a very alien and exciting idea to me when that started to happen with the first book, because I just had not thought of that. And so, and I got to do a little bit of travel, like Australia and Poland and Italy. So that, I mean, that's a small thing, but I just, it's not something that's a huge thing. I just mean, it's not like important in the grand scheme of being a writer, but it was just a really exciting thing to get to do that I had no idea was, I just had never really thought about that that might be part of it. So that was expecting.
Yeah. As you're going into your second book or now that you've published your second book, was there anything that felt really different or unexpected in that way? Or, oh, okay, this was more normal or.
I mean, since I had been through it once before, it was less, it was like, there was the same amount of like nervousness, but it wasn't as unfamiliar, like what the things that could happen are. Yeah. So there was like more worry the second time because I didn't know. It was like, well, last time this happened, like, is that going to happen again? You know, like maybe, like there was maybe a little bit more of that. Yeah. But it's still, every new book is feels like nerve wracking to put out into the world. My first book really just, my whole life totally changed.
Oh.
So that was the, wow. I feel like that was the big change. And that was just like a big piece of luck that I wasn't expecting. So the second one was more just about the book, which was exciting, but it was less about maybe like my identity and like what I'm doing with my life. Mm. Whereas that first one, just because I got very lucky with, you know, the sale of it and then selling in other countries, like I quit my job and it just changed my life. So the second one was more about just the book, which was exciting and good, but
How did you navigate that? Because it was a surprise in such a good way. How did you navigate those big changes and you know, I guess, like, keep on an even keel or get back on an even keel?
I mean, I noticed that it was easier to write a few years after that. Like, the further I got from the initial publication of my first book, it felt easier to write because I like the feeling of being, like, just in my own space writing and not as in touch with what, like, the reviews are going to say or whatever. So I can feel it already now with my second book, with The Dreamers. Like, it's kind of nice to be moving out of that, like, initial review phase where I have, like, things memorized, not on purpose, but just, like, lines from reviews, like, planted into my head. That's distracting.
Hopefully all good ones.
Well, you never remember the good ones. So.
I think both. Because good runs, then the next project you're like, but is this overflowing with humanity? Like, that's not helpful. And that's a good one. And then obviously negative ones are like, am I doing that again? Or you just have like a little argument in your head, like, no, I don't agree with that. Like, anyway, it's publication is a distracting time. Mm. And then it's nice to, even though it's exciting, it's also nice to like get quieter again and be able to just be more in touch with, I mean, I think it's important to think about what the reader of a book is going, like, I never want to lose touch with that, but the useful one to me is to imagine myself reading it and what would I, like, if someone gave me this piece of writing, what would I, as a reader, be bothered by? And that's what I try to work on, just because that's just the one that I feel like I can put, maybe there's a chance of pleasing or satisfying, whereas, like, other readers or the general readership is, like, you can never fully please. So anyway, it's good to be in touch with like the idea of a reader, but for me it's eventually good to not have like individual like Amazon reviews or like something someone said at a reading like in my head. It's like distracting. So
so we like to end each interview with a little spot of inspiration for our writers striving to master their class. Do you have a last piece of wisdom to leave them with? Maybe a best piece of advice you ever received, a quotation that drives you?
Let's see. I just yesterday saw a quote that was David Carr. He's like a journalist, and his daughter recently wrote a memoir, and she posted a quote of his that was about how what really like sort of sets, I don't know if it's an artist in general or writers in particular, apart is a certain kind of humility, which I feel like is really true. And it's something about, he said something about how like a humility and a kind of willingness to let the world reveal something to you, like, you know, that we don't know everything going in. And I feel like that about writing a lot, that to be able to let your ego go as a, on the page, and to think like, I mean, it's a delicate balance because you don't want to be too self-critical in a way that's paralyzing, but to feel humble and be able, like, how am I going to do it next time? And to feel like that you can always get better. I feel like that's a useful thing. And then I guess the other thing that is much older advice for me is just, I had two of my college professors, or no, one in college, one in graduate school, just really harped on the idea of revision. And just like, I think one of them said the difference between a published piece of writing and unpublished piece of writing is 100 hours or 50 drafts or something extreme like that. You know, just that's really like such a big part of it. Just like going over it again and again and again to make it, as close to perfect as you can get it. So I guess those are the things I'll leave you with. They were useful to me.
Lovely. Thank you. So how can people find you out in the world and the interwebs?
The main thing that I use is Instagram. So I think it's just Karen Thompson Walker on Instagram. So okay. That's the one that I like. Okay, great. Right. Thank you. And thanks again for having me. It was really nice. Yeah,
Karen, thank you so much. We really appreciate you being here. This was wonderful. And Leah, thanks for joining me today. And
thank you.
We will talk to you. I guess we will talk with our listeners soon. Thanks.
Thank you.